Welcome to Richmond Law and Policy's podcast series. Richmond Law and Policy is a social justice law firm specializing in consumer protection class actions, representation of nonprofits and progressive businesses, and civil rights litigation concerning police misconduct. Our first season gets to the core of systemic issues regarding factory farming and is intended for educational purposes only.
Thank you so much, Jack, and thank you, Dr. Thu. I think we might want to start with you just introducing yourself and who you are and what you do.
Okay. My name is Kendall Thu. I'm a professor of anthropology at Northern Illinois University with a specialty in food systems, environmental health, and social justice. And I've been at NIU. This is my 22nd year. Before then, I was at the University of Iowa as a researcher in the College of Medicine for about 7 years. And I received my PhD in anthropology in 1992, back in the Paleocene.
Thank you. So you told us a little bit about what you do, but how does your work relate to the larger issue that CAFOs present?
Well, at the heart of the CAFO issue is really a political issue. It's about the consolidation of power and money. CAFOs represent the centralization of the food system, and CAFOs bring with them a whole host of problems, environmental problems, air and water, problems of public health, the health of the workers inside the CAFO, health of the animals, and the health of neighbors. And we've got a lot of research on each of those areas. But in order to address any one of those areas, you have to address the power and the money behind it all, because changing this industry is exceedingly difficult because there's so much money and so much power and so much clout that the industry has. So that's the way I see it. CAFOs are emblematic of a centralized political system where people in rural areas who are faced with CAFOs have very little recourse to fix the situation, even though they're the ones that are being aggrieved.
Oh, that's powerful. Thank you. So what can communities do to fight off CAFOs?
Well, there's a number of things that they can try. One is to organize. Organize neighbors, rural community members. That serves as mutual support. It also serves to mount political power or political force. You can sometimes create a nonprofit entity. So that's one thing to do, and it's very important. There are a number of networks that can be linked into so that you can see what other communities have tried, what has succeeded, what has failed. So organizing is very important. It's also important for individuals to have mutual support. Other things that can be done include contacting your legislators, writing letters to the editor in the local newspaper, contacting your local representative, connecting with pro bono legal clinics, connecting with organizations that are sympathetic. There are a number of them in various states and nationally, and publicly hold accountable who's behind the building of these CAFOs, and showing off the point that they're not being community friendly, they're not neighbor friendly. Rural communities are often thought of as being everybody knows everybody. And so you can put social pressure on people who are building these facilities, but also be respectful and mindful that many times the CAFO is being built and operated through a contract arrangement, and the farmer themselves may not have a whole lot of say about what they're doing. But the fact is that they agreed to enter into the contract. But sometimes these farmers are desperate because of the farm economy. They don't know which way to turn. So those are some tactics that can be used. Really, the most effective is to file suit, depending upon the statute in the particular state. There have been several successful nuisance suits. Even in the case of my camp, where I live, there was a successful nuisance case that was won before it got to court. So if you look at all the tools available to people, the one that is most effective is filing a suit. So a nuisance suit is based on common law. It dates back to 16th, 17th century England. And what it means is that you can't erode the quality of my life or my property without giving me something in return. So if you build a CAFO, what you're going to get as a neighbor is you're going to get odor and other elements of air emissions from the CAFO. And that's going to land on your property, in your yard, in your house. And a lot of times, particularly in the South, homes are extensions of the outer doors. That's part of you. That's part of what is enjoyable about living in the country and in the out of doors. When a CAFO comes, it's an assault on that singular quality of life element of people who live in rural areas. So that's the problem. People, rather than having a house that they enjoy, the house becomes a prison that they harbor in to escape the intrusion from the neighboring CAFOs.
Can you tell us a little bit about permitting issues in the state of Illinois?
So each state differs a little bit. So I can tell you what is specific to Illinois, and then I can tell you something about permitting processes that applies to the entire country. So in the state of Illinois, you have to get a construction permit from the Department of Agriculture. Now, the Department of Agriculture is not typically a permitting agency. It's not a regulatory agency. It's usually basically a chamber of commerce office for agriculture. So, but you have to get a permit from the state ag department. And there are certain provisions and information that you have to have. However, the Department of Agriculture in Illinois has never turned down a permit for a CAFO. So, in fact, a lawsuit was filed in my county contending that constitutionally challenging the Department of Agriculture as a permitting institution because they have never turned down a permit. So they're technically not a permitting agency. So in the permit itself, then the applicant has to provide certain information, the size of the facility, how you're going to dispose of the manure, a plan for manure disposal. And you have to use certain agronomic rates of absorption for the manure, and lots of other details. But what's really the point here is that the farmer themselves or the contractor themselves are self-inspecting. That is, they're the ones that have to come up with a plan, but they're also the ones that are going to regulate themselves. That's not a particularly good regulatory system. It's like the fox guarding the hen house. And inspectors do go out upon request from neighbors, but it's not a regular inspection routine after the facility is built. So that's kind of the state, and that's fairly common among states. There are states that are a little more rigorous, like Minnesota is much more rigorous than Illinois. Iowa is about the same. North Carolina is about the same. But federally, these facilities should be regulated under the Clean Water Act. When the Clean Water Act was passed in 1973 under the Nixon administration, CAFOs were specifically mentioned in the language. They were specifically mentioned that they needed to be regulated and that they needed to have what are called National Pollution Discharge Elimination System permits. And that's the permit that municipal wastewater treatment plants have to have. It's a permit that other large industries have to have to allow them to regulate what they can discharge into surface bodies, and that's a national program. States and regions vary in how well they issue these permits. In the state of Illinois, when I had a law student and a student of mine get involved, we went down to the Illinois State EPA, which is supposed to be issuing clean water permits for CAFOs. And we discovered they hadn't issued a single permit. despite the fact that they had a number of CAFOs violating the Clean Water Act multiple times, and they were never issued a clean water permit. That led us in the coalition that I helped form called the Illinois Citizens for Clean Air and Water to spend a couple of years filing a petition with the federal government to strip away the state EPA's authority to administer the Clean Water Act. That led to the federal EPA coming in and doing a year and a half, 2 year investigation of the state EPA and the regional offices. And in response to our filings, they found about 95% of what we alleged was actually true. And they required the state to come into compliance. So those petitions have been used in other places around the country. I think we've been one of the most effective. And there's that very clever provision of the Clean Water Act that says, if you can show the federal government that your state is not appropriately administering the NPDES program or the Clean Water Act, then you can fill in their shoes and take over. And that's effectively what we did. And as soon as the feds gave their report, then suddenly the state EPA they listened to us, finally. Otherwise, they wouldn't. And that's the other part of the problem. These state agencies across the country that administer permitting programs or the Clean Water Act, they're often bedfellows with the industry. It's another part of the problem with the consolidation of power and money.
So what are some of the political and social ramifications of filing suit, and how does this affect your relationship with your community?
One of the things that you find in some rural communities is an aversion to conflict and confrontation. So you want to get along, you want to go along to get along. And so there's sometimes a reluctance to file suit, because oftentimes the people you would be filing suit against are your neighbors, people you know, and members of your family or relatives. I've seen that so many times where they're actually filing suit against someone they're related to. So it's difficult. The other challenge is it takes money. Unless you can find pro bono help, it takes money to hire attorneys. Attorneys have to hire expert witnesses, and they have to, of course, get paid for their time. So, and neighbors of these facilities don't have the same amount of money and connections that the facility owners and contractors of the companies that are behind the contract have. So that's a problem. And then you have to prove the case. Nuisance cases is a little bit less burdensome than, let's say, trespass or I'm trying to think of a higher bar case. If it's a health problem, if it's creating health issues, then that's a higher bar. Nuisance can include disruption of your quality of life. It can include symptoms that you say you're experiencing within the context of quality of life. It can include, my kids can't go outside and play. I can't go and garden. I can't mow the lawn. I can't go for walks. I can't have a social gathering in the backyard with my neighbors and friends. Those are all just normal quality of life activities. I've been in households where parents get in arguments with each other because of what's happening to their kids playing outside. So it has this ripple effect on all facets of quality of life that a lot of people don't realize. They think of just the odor and people smelling it, but it has deep-seated consequences for all aspects of life when you're living in rural areas.
Thank you. One question I have that's sort of a follow-up on the previous question is about the relationship between your scholarship and your community organizing. It's clear that you've done a lot of both. And I imagine that they're probably related, but could you talk a little bit about those two commitments that you have?
Sure. So I do both qualitative and quantitative work in my research. And on both sides, I believe strongly in community-based participatory research. Building up trust with community members who are participating in research with me. This is something that my my colleague, Steve Wing, who passed away several years ago, he and I worked on relentlessly. So I don't see my research as being separate from my community engagement. In fact, they're part and parcel of the same thing. I think I have a responsibility in my research to work with communities, to be a partner, a reciprocal partner, in a non-hierarchical way, where we ask questions together and we do the research together and we look at the findings together. And then sometimes we actually publish together too, depending upon who's involved. So I'm often asked by my students and others, well, are you then independent and are you biased because you're working with these communities? And my answer is absolutely not. If you have cancer, you treat the cancer for what it is, and you do so hating the cancer, right? And you do everything you can to address it. These people are aggrieved, and the research shows it in multiple ways. And so I have a responsibility to try to do something about it. Since these community members are giving their time to me, they're giving me their stories, they're sharing their family stories, and I benefit because I can publish it in peer-reviewed journals, and I get tenure for it. So what do they get out of it? Well, they get the research, but they all ought to have my involvement and my help. And so that's why I do it. I feel like I have a responsibility and a commitment to do that.
Thank you. And could you speak to some of your published work related to CAFOs?
Well, I've published quite a bit. I guess I can characterize it as some of it's on the public health side. I published the very first article looking at the potential health effects of CAFOs on neighbors. We did the first pilot study ever. That was back in 1996, 97. That launched a whole series of subsequent research by myself and others, all of which confirmed the very first small study that we did. So I've done work on the public health end of things. I've done work on water quality, worked with the CDC and researchers in Iowa to look at water contamination from CAFOs. I've done work on environmental justice issues, the placement of CAFOs in communities, disproportionate placement of CAFOs in communities of color. I've done many oral histories with rural residents who are experiencing problems with CAFOs. So I sort of come at it not only with the environmental justice aspect, but also with sort of an oral history dimension to it too. And I still have many stories that I still can't believe. And then getting back to what I said at the outset, I also look at the political dynamics, tracing the power. This is something that I think LOCA is doing a marvelous job at, much better than I ever could. You really have to understand something about the relationships between companies, the structure of their businesses, and how they're related to political entities. I remember vividly, probably 20, 25 years ago, I was in a household, a Republican household, and they were describing their woes with the next door CAFO. And I remember the gentleman saying to me, you know, I called Jesse Helms and he talked to me about it. And he said, Jesse Helms couldn't do anything about it. He said, if Jesse Helms can't do anything about it, well, what am I going to do? So it's kind of funny because if you talk to white neighbors and African-American neighbors at these facilities, suffer similar kinds of quality of life issues with CAFOs coming in. But with African-American communities, what they will say, well, this is just another chapter, another song and dance in a long history of injustice. And the white communities will often say, geez, I didn't know this was going on. They sort of are surprised that they can't get anything done, even if they have the resources to do something. So there's a cultural dimension to my research as well. But I think, you know, environmental, public health, political health, social health, environmental justice, those are all parts of what I
do. So I'm curious about the oral histories you mentioned, and wonder if you have any stories that you would want to share.
Yeah, let's see. What can I think of? When I was working with Steve Wang, I did many oral histories with a woman by the name of Naima Mohammed. Anyway, at the time, she was a community organizer for the city of the little town of Tillery in North Carolina, not too far from Warren County, North Carolina, which is the origins of the environmental justice movement in this country. Anyway, Naima and I were on the road. We were on the road a lot, and we ended up at the household of this older Black woman and her mother. And her mother was suffering from Alzheimer's, but they didn't have any health care. And here comes a CAFO into their neighborhood. And I just couldn't stand it. I mean, it was just so pathetic. And after our interview, I remember walking out, getting in the car, and Naima saying to me, "That woman has no idea what she's facing with her mother." It's incredible to think that people are already marginalized, they get hit with health issues, and then on top of that, they're kicked when they're down by having a CAFO come into their neighborhood. And remember, many of these neighborhoods, they were there first. Land ownership among African Americans is a very meaningful part of their life. It means a lot to own land and own a house. And these ownerships are passed down through the generations. And that's part of what I learned in the oral histories is how meaningful it is to have their own land, given the history that they've inherited in the South and elsewhere, of course, as well. I can publish all I want, and my publications can affect maybe 10, 15 people. And they can collect dust on a library shelf. I guess that's virtual these days. But the real reward are the people that you meet and the relationships that you build. I still am connected with the people that I interviewed on Facebook, the folks that I met in the early 90s. And activists that I met way back then. So Facebook has a certain reward for me, but it's that engagement and seeing people's willingness to share their lives with you and share their stories. Those are immeasurable, and they last a lifetime. And by the way, the opposite of that is true too. So people who see what you're doing and don't like it, they know what you're doing. And you know, I had challenges as a young scholar in trying to publish and get a job because I was being threatened, and I was being intimidated, or they attempted to intimidate me. And the same thing with Steve Wang and others. That's rampant. But they don't bother me now because I'm older and more established. But that's part of the political problem is, who's going to do this kind of research? How many locas and how many KCs do we have out there that are going to do the research, that can get the funding, that can get published, and that are willing to testify in court, willing to testify in state legislatures, and willing to testify to Congress? When the ruling came down about what you can use as evidentiary value in the federal courts, which trickled down to the state courts, it made it harder for expert witnesses to be admitted into cases. And that had its chilling effect on faculty who might otherwise testify. So it's just part of the political landscape that makes this challenge even greater. But there are a lot of really talented, very smart, very dedicated folks out there who are, I think, up to the challenge.
I know that when you first spoke with Jack in your pre-interview, you talked about a judge who dealt with a CAFO moving in close to his home. Could you share that story here?
Yeah, so I live in DeKalb County, Illinois, which is about 60 miles west of Chicago. So it's a university town, but it's a rural town. And in the southeast portion of the county, We have a resident who is a retired state Supreme Court judge. And he and his wife were living there in their retirement years when they caught wind, no pun intended, of a CAFO that was going to be built near their retirement home. And so they contacted me, they meaning that couple and their neighbors, contacted me, and I went to several meetings that were held in the garage, sort of just classic grassroots meetings. So they had folding chairs set up in the garage, and they asked me to come in and talk to them. And I did. But the upshot of it all was that this state Supreme Court judge had very little recourse like every other rural resident. There was not much that he could do. However, he did know the law a little bit better than others. And so, like others, he hired a local attorney. And that local attorney faced the same problems that every other attorney faces with these cases, which is it's hard to prove. But ultimately, he had the money, they had the money to come to an agreement to create an easement between where the CAFO would have been built and their property. But that cost them money. They had to pay for the easement in order to keep the CAFO out. But an important point in all of this is that in many respects, even a retired state Supreme Court justice had very little recourse as well. The law was just not on his side. And that was very telling. I remember, I got to tell this story. Many years ago, I got to meet the U.S. Senate Senator for one term under Jimmy Carter. And he was also the former Attorney General of North Carolina. And he's a Democrat, and he prosecuted a lot of consumer fraud, consumer rights cases. And he got into the business of dealing with CAFOs. And we went out to dinner one night. I said, you know, you've been dealing with the tobacco industry here in North Carolina for years, so you must know about big business and agriculture and the kind of clout and influence they have. And he looked at me and said, no, I've never seen anything like the CAFO industry. I met him. My colleague and I, Paul Dernberger, were interviewing some residents in a household and residents of near a CAFO that happened to be built. And Robert Morgan was sitting in the corner just taking notes, and we didn't know who he was. And then after we had gotten done talking to the residents, he wanted to go out to lunch with us. And that's when we learned who he was. I stayed in touch with him for many, many years until he passed away. Wonderful man, wonderful lawyer.
A question that I find myself continuously asking people who do this sort of work, do you ever feel powerless? And how do you kind of maintain motivation in front of that or in face of that?
Yeah, I think it's fair to say that I've often felt frustrated and felt powerless. I remember when the very first thing that we published based upon our work in North Carolina in, I don't remember what it was, 93, 94, we published an op-ed piece in the Des Moines Register sharing what we had found in North Carolina. And North Carolina was being looked upon at the time by Iowa as the future for livestock production in Iowa. So when we published that piece, shit hit the fan. So I got contacted by the Farm Bureau. I got contacted by legislators. And I got contacted by an ag economist at the University of Missouri who tried to intimidate me and tried to downplay what I was saying. And that was, but by the way, that phone call from that ag economist came a day after the birth of our first child, while my wife was laying on the couch with our first daughter. And at that moment, I felt angry. I felt my life was being invaded. I felt threatened. And it dawned on me, you know what? This is what these rural residents are feeling. So I had an aha moment. That this is what they're going through, at least in some sense. The way to sort of bolster yourself when you have those down and out moments is to remember all the people that you you're connected with. You turn to each other for help, for support. And that, for me, it's also my colleagues that help support as well. But it's not easy. It really isn't. And one farmer once said to me one time, you know, I'm glad you're out here. I'm glad you're doing the work you're doing. But remember where you go home at night. Well, I go home at night and I sleep well. And by the way, I do have a CAFO that exists 2 miles from me. But it doesn't bother me that much because it's a family farmer. I know when they're going to spread manure. I know how long it's going to last. And I don't mind it. That's much different than when you're in a situation where you don't have the resources to move, and it's there almost constantly. So, but back to your question, it's hard. It's really hard. And it's hard, particularly in this climate, quite frankly, with so many layers of stress that people are experiencing.
Thank you again to Dr. Thu for speaking with us today. And thank you, Casey Vick, for conducting the interview. Special thanks to SRAP, FLAG, and many others for making this possible. Thank you.